This is an oral history of artist and activist Estria Miyashiro for the Mission Murals Project. I'm Camilo Garzón. It was recorded on July 13, 2021, simultaneously from Honolulu, Hawaii at 8 a.m. and from my apartment in Oakland, California at 11 a.m. The voices you'll hear will be Estria's and my own. You can also hear Estria doodling throughout the oral history while he recounts his memories, prolific visual arts career, and life. When we talked, he was wearing a green, button-up, short-sleeved shirt with yellow prints of leaves. This oral history delves into Estria's personal life and his work as an artist. He shares his experiences moving from Hawaii to San Francisco after high school, learning to tag and write in the 80s in the Bay Area, and developing his work with artists like Crayon. We talk about his initial interest in mural making, what he learned from artists like Susan Cervantes at Presida Eyes Muralists, and artist-activist Nancy Pili Hernandez, while working on the Water Rights Project. Estria also discusses his work in Hawaii and the Mele Murals Project. In our time together, he takes us on a journey through the expanse of public art and activism he generated throughout the years, his role in preserving and amplifying his own Hawaiian heritage, and carving out his own legacy through the arts. Here is the oral history. Today is July 13th, and I'm here with Estria Miyashiro, and I'm talking to him on behalf of the Mission Murals Project. If you can say your name, and also where were you born exactly?
Aloha, my name is Estria Miyashiro. I'm born in Honolulu, Hawaii.
Perfect. And when you think of your upbringing in Honolulu and all of the beauty that surrounded you, as well as just the very specific situation in the island when you were born, what are some of the memories that come to mind?
Well, Hawaii's paradise, you know, it's beautiful. There's the energy of the land and waters are strong, so you feel this specialness of the place. You feel the place is alive, and you might not even realize that when you're a young person, but it affects you, you know. So when I moved to San Francisco and started building an art career, you still long for Hawaii. You still feel like that's your home. So even though you're a couple thousand miles away, you still feel like you're right there, you know. It never leaves you in your heart. So that shapes who you are and what you're doing. And then in Hawaii, like, we all have, it's all about connection in Hawaii. Like, connection to each other, connection to the land, connection, you know, in our stories. And so that, you're always painting, thinking, like, who are you accountable to? You know, who are you painting? Who's going to see this? You know, I've painted some kind of crazy or irresponsible things when I was younger, but, you know, you're always thinking about, oh, what if my grandmother sees this? Right? What is she going to feel? So I think that helps shape you to become a community artist. I don't know. Maybe it just shaped me because there's not that many community artists from Hawaii.
I think that's part of it, though. Like, as you're saying, it's nice to hear that this was part of just your context and also just the nature around you, but also your family. There's one thing that I remember that is when you were in school, I think you've said before, that, you know, math, algebra, there's some subjects that people are more interested in and some subjects that some other people are not as interested in, as happens with life. But you used to do something very peculiar, very specific with algebra in your paper. Do you remember what I'm referencing?
I think so. Algebra for me was something I couldn't comprehend. So the textbook became my sketchbook. You know, I was zoning out in the class, started doodling, and I think because I couldn't get it, that I couldn't even handle like football physics, which is like the science class for the football team, you know. It I gravitated towards art. So in a way, it helped me know that, okay, math, science, that's not my career path. And art was something I really loved, or was coming to love at that point.
Yeah, and then one of the things is you were using those, you know, parts of the algebra book as the sketchbook. What were some of the images when you were a kid that you were just like trying to, or a teenager that you were starting to doodle? Were there things like specifically like mountains or like the ocean or like even like food? What were some of those images you started using?
When I started doodling in the math book, it was just like, I don't know, doing little graffiti pieces of this girl's name. And then one day, a classmate walked by, and he looks at it, and he goes, oh, you're a graffiti artist. And I go, yeah. And then he walks away, and I'm thinking, what's a graffiti artist, you know? And then, I don't know, probably a couple of weeks later, my breakdancer friends, they're always looking for anything like breakdancing because it just wasn't much available back then. You know, we didn't have internet. Weren't a lot of magazines. So whatever they'd find on breakdancing, we'd see graffiti stuff in the backgrounds or on their denim jackets. And we were always curious what that was about. So then one day we just got an airbrush kit, hopped the fence, and went in a canal and painted. And then I fell in love with that.
That sounds fun, and not only fun, but also just another way of using those same kind of images you were already making, but in a way that also was sharing with friends, it seems, and also like you saw something in you that someone else saw first, right? Like you were like, oh, a graffiti artist, I don't know what it is, but now I'm interested. What is this, right? That word, graffiti, and that's something we were just talking about a few minutes ago. There's many connotations, right? And the original connotation, supposedly, it's that it's scratch or scratches on the walls, especially like in Italy when it came out. In the United States, it has been used in many ways that are, in a sense, penalizing these kind of public art. And in your early years and then throughout your life, how have you seen that word? What does that word mean to Estria?
Yeah, I agree. The original definition of the word graffiti was to scratch or to scribe into a surface. And then when you look at dictionaries that are made in modern times, they've changed the definition of it to include the American media version of what graffiti is. So in style writing, which is what I come from, they call it the G word. You know, it's like the bad word that you don't use because it's the media trying to label us as something, just like vandals, right? That's what people from Europe. That's not destroying signs and stuff. And it's a way to kind of quickly summarize who we are or what we do and give it a negative connotation, as opposed to, you know, they could have called us storytellers or communicators or, and it would have had a positive connotation, right? Like trying to communicate something, trying to share something that's as common as humans and through all time.
Yeah, there's that dimension. And I feel like you have consistently pushed for that recognition of what you do as not only like storytelling or as you have called it also writing, but also just as a tool, right? As an education tool and as a way of also knowing who we are or who people are in the communities that you've been a part of. Especially these days that it has been consistently tied your graffiti work, your storytelling work with your education work and activism. All of those are connected. They're not separate. I think that it is very clear that all of them are connected. I think that one of the important things is you did go from a place that you were born and raised, which is in Hawaii, and then you ended up in the West Coast of the United States, specifically in the San Francisco Bay Area. And those kinds of things are big, especially when you're young. Do you remember how you felt when you had just moved into San Francisco?
Oh, yeah. I'll never forget how I felt when I moved to San Francisco. So it was fall of 86. I came for college, actually, at University of San Francisco, and they had a partnership with the Academy of Art College. So you could get a degree from USF, but get taught the art from the Academy, which was a little bit more credible than a degree from the Academy at the time. So for me, you know, I couldn't wait to get out of my parents' house. I didn't realize that how much of a, like, free spirit I was. Try to run away and stuff, you know. And so to come to San Francisco was the way out of my parents' house. It was the way to, like, start my life and be free, more so than, oh, I'm going to get an education, you know. And then when I got here, it was, I think, 2 weeks before school started. So I had a little time to explore. And a classmate of mine, he ended up becoming my best friend, and we still work together to this day. He also went to the same school, and he was like a legendary king already in Hawaii for graffiti. And then, and I was nobody in Hawaii. And then when we came to San Francisco with those 2 weeks, like, hey, let's hop the bus and go around and see what's available. I mean, what kind of pieces there are. So we just take the buses to the ends of the lines and back. And we saw amazing parks like Crocker, Silver Terrace, these other sites that were like more like South San Francisco, you know, Daly City side of that area of San Francisco. It's just like full of these vibrant pieces with styles and color schemes that we've never used in Hawaii. So back then, like I said, there wasn't internet. If you wanted to see pieces from another city, you either had to go there or you had to meet someone and then physically mail each other photos. So going to see that was hugely inspirational for us. There was a guy named Doug One from TMF, and he had amazing characters. There's a guy named Guess. They were friends. Guess had, like, amazing pieces. So that stuff got us excited. So before college even started, we're already painting the project rooftops, you know, just going for it. And I think that kind of set the tone of what my college experience was going to be like, because I wasn't at school as I should have been. I was out painting, you know. And you know, going to art college was an interesting thing where you're trying to learn skills to make money off of it. But then I had to get jobs to pay for school in the meantime, art jobs. And then coming from a graffiti background is very different than those artists. A lot of those kids, they're like well-off kids, you know. I don't know. They don't know what to do, so they become an artist or something. They don't all necessarily have that drive, that determination, like, oh, I gotta be this artist thing. Whereas the folks that were struggling, or even the folks that had a career and realized that that wasn't the career for them and going back, you know, they were motivated to make something of themselves. And coming from writing, you know, we have this mentality of, like, I'm gonna battle you, I'm gonna smoke you, I'm gonna compete with you all the time. So I was always comparing myself against my peers and classmates and trying to outdo them. So those kids, you know, they take winter break, summer break, they go home, they don't do art, they just, I don't know, hang out with family. But for me, I had to live off of it already, so I'm hustling, you know, I'm lining up gigs, I'm doing whatever I can. So when they come back from break, it's like they've kind of regressed a few weeks in their skills, whereas my skills moved forward a little bit because I was continually working on stuff. So eventually I kind of pushed to the front of the class, you know. But, you know, later you grow up and you realize that you can't use other people as your motivation. You got to just look inwards to improve yourself. So there was a very striking difference in the perspective of art, both in aesthetics and in the competitiveness from folks on the street versus those in school. And I think those in school were just looking to make money, but coming from the streets was more of, how does this connect with people you know, why do we paint the streets instead of trying to go into galleries like those other art students? And realizing early on, man, millions of people pass my piece in a month, and you're never going to get that number of people in a gallery or a museum. So, yeah, it was all about painting streets. Or trains or trucks or whatever you could get your hands on.
Anything that was around, and it also is the same kind of thing, that it is not only about the art, right? It's also about the connecting with others, or like making sure that others see what is out there, that they are able to still have art. Because as you're saying, galleries, museums, it has had, and it has been still to this day, somewhat exclusive, but instead you always gravitated to the art that was gonna be, as you're saying, it's on the street, they're gonna see it, and I can always go to different places and just not only continue getting better, because you had that drive, but also just get to know more of the city and of yourself through it, right? It was always like a feedback loop. And as you said, even before you started in USF, you already had worked outside on the streets. You were getting to know what was going on, and you already were making art. It wasn't that you went to school to make art. You already were making art and then also went to school. When you think of those times in school, but also after school, how did your conception of art while you were living in San Francisco change? Or not only the, as you were saying, like you were just tagging or writing, or there were different ways of you working. How did those kinds of things change? Like, did you start doing different kinds of street art as well that you hadn't tried before? Or did you stay in one realm? Like, what was the combination of things?
Oh, that's a good question, Camilo. When I came into San Francisco, the first group of writers that I connected with were, they became a crew called Together with Style. And they were known on the West Coast for innovative styles of not following the styles that were coming out of New York and Chicago, you know, but trying to break the rules. And realizing that New York had trains, so your pieces either had to fit below the windows of a train or on the whole car. But we had walls, so we could do different compositions, different colors. You could do more elaborate stuff because you could go back multiple times. Like, whereas with a train, it's gone the next morning, right? You don't know if you're going to see that train again. So they were very innovative, and that was a huge inspiration for me to explore the styles, explore the flows of letters, techniques. I think the other main crew at the time that got me excited was Doug One's TMF, the Mellow Fellows. And they were known for that sort of classic, you know, window down or whole car kind of graffiti styles. That they believed that styles had to stay connected to its New York roots. And I often wonder, what if I had met those guys first? Then I might have got sucked into that way of thinking, you know? But for whatever reason, I met up with Creon and his crew, and it just allowed me to explore things. So I felt comfortable trying different things. Bam and I would look at, like, you know, most writers would look at other writers, or they would look at Von Bode's underground comic book, something simple that would translate well on a train, you know, flat color, stylish outline. But we would look at fashion illustration, or, you know, illustrations on magazine covers, anything. So we would experiment with techniques, with colors, with applications. And then we also weren't afraid to do non-hip-hop look. You know, everybody was doing b-boys or DJs, you know, spray graffiti characters. And we're just doing totally weird stuff. A lot of it sucked, you know, but we were free to explore things. And so I think that And my background was that as a teenager, I spent my years at the YMCA in my neighborhood. So it was always about helping kids, giving back to community, and also dreaming of how to change the world or make it a better place, and then methodically going about doing that. So those are the kind of things that I learned as a young person. So then with the first Iraq war, I was really motivated by that. So I went around the city writing stuff about it, you know, made a little magazine with Twist and some other guys about the BS that was happening with that, how the U.S. manipulated things to start that war. And I would even go on the streets and say that I was doing a report for school and like interviewed complete strangers on the streets. And then if the quotes moved me, I would go tag those quotes at night, you know, on playgrounds and schoolyards and stuff. So I think that's why the city had it in for me, because I was writing political stuff. But that connection with those writers, I feel, gave me the okay to go do things like political graffiti that had nothing to do with style writing.
There's just so much wealth of, you know, community and also media that you're also learning from, that also got into, as you're saying, your work, including, as you're saying, that you were just talking to just passerby or just like a, you know, someone and asking them something, and if it moved you enough, just writing it and making sure that it was present for others to see. And that kind of conversation that the city is speaking back to the people, you were also making that happen. And you did have some media attention, which we will get into in a second, which I find and if you think of even that time, just in the 80s especially, when you were just not only learning, at that point you were also just able to, as you were saying, explore and also getting to more specific things that you were getting interested into, like these kinds of like what we would call political stuff, which at the end of the day is also just very much a human conversation with the city. A lot of these things become political just because others didn't want to listen to the things that you were saying, but they were just things that you just talked to someone on the street and they were just part of the conversation. They just became public because you made them public. But these were things that were going on. The ideologies, the narratives, all of these things. So what happened when you did get that kind of media attention? I talked to Nancy Pili Hernandez about this, and it was just so interesting, her perspective on it, which, you know, she loves you as a friend and colleague, and we can talk about the water rights in a second. But what happened, in your own words, and why is it that they were talking about you in the way that they were?
Anybody born after 1984 in a major city in the United States does not know what a city full of bare walls looks like, right? So my generation is like the last that remembers, like, oh, I remember there was no such thing as murals, you know, it was just bare walls. So for our generation to, because of style writing, to realize like, oh, what would that wall over there look like with this color, you know, this big bang, you turn the corner and boom, this thing just captures you. So we wanted to put that everywhere. And I think that's why it was a golden age in style writing at that time, because everybody felt that excitement, you know? And also, there just weren't enough cops to catch all of us, I think. But that excitement of transforming spaces from blank stuff to colored things, you know, making something out of nothing, being a creator in that way was super exciting. And I don't think future generations have that level of excitement. So, you know, with that, we were painting a lot of stuff. And to rise to the top in a city like San Francisco, you've got to paint a lot, and then you have to get good at it. And I was horrible at it in the beginning. I didn't even know I was horrible, right, until I started noticing that, oh, people don't take pictures of my stuff. They don't waste film. It was film back then on my pieces. So to get good, I figured that if I drew more or painted more hours than everybody else, I was slowly catch up or even pass them. And that's what I did. So in our, together with Style Crew, we would have contests like who could do the most pieces in a month, who could do the most sketches, hour sketching in a month or whatever, you know. And we'd bet for like 100 cans each, which is a lot. So we'd have to go steal all that. But anyway, that's a whole nother story. So we were going out all the time painting. And then somehow, how did it happen? Somehow I was painting a truck. And it was interesting. It was these two guys. They were famous for driving around the country and then stopping in different places and then making videos and blogging about their experiences there. I think they were two gay guys, so it was a different perspective. At the time, there wasn't a lot of gay voice in media. So they were just boldly sharing their views of things. And they were smart and intelligent and perceptive. So it was enjoyable to watch and read what they were doing, you know. So one day I saw their Monkmobile coming down San Francisco. And I was like, oh, my God, I gotta paint that because everybody's going to see it. So I, you know, pulled to the side and talked to them. And they're like, yeah, come paint it. We're going to do this book fair. So I'm painting in front of this book fair, and this teacher walks out and she goes, will you come teach my class? I have no money. Oh, all right. So we went and taught this class, and then stupid me invites the head of Department of Public Works, which does the anti-graffiti, right? Because I'm thinking if we can shift their perspective somehow, then we can work with them, not realizing that he's like the devil incarnate and just has it in for me. You know, he just thinks I'm like the kingpin of graffiti or a kingpin, and you know, if he takes me down, he'll take down a bunch of people. So when he saw our class, he was pissed. So then you know, I'm out doing my thing one night, tagging and again writing political stuff in the neighborhood, and then they got lucky, an off-duty cop caught me. So I didn't think he was a cop, otherwise I would have ran earlier. Would have ducked into the trees in the park and hid out. So it got lucky, it caught me, and then somehow that DPW head heard about it. So he talked to the judge and was like, you can't release this person. You know, so they raised my bail to like $50,000. You know, your graffiti kid bail bond is like $5,000, so I have to get people to get my credit cards to float that. But yeah, so I got busted. And this is about maybe 1994 or something. And in the historical context, an American young man had gone to Singapore, I think it was, and I don't know, he was smashing signs with another youth from that country. Like, you know, actually destroying things, public property things. And so they caught him and the other kid. And out there, the penalty is they cane you. They give you lashings. And so it was a big deal in U.S. media because people were starting to get frustrated with graffiti, didn't understand it. It was becoming so prevalent that, you know, the people were saying, we should cane them here. You know, we should lash them here. So the U.S. tried to intervene on that kid's behalf and say, you shouldn't lash them. And they're like, this is our country and these are our rules, so we'll be nice and we'll just give him 11 lashings instead of, well, we're going to give him like 30. So that just happens. Then I get busted right after San Francisco raised it from a misdemeanor. You would just get a ticket. You know, like if a cop saw you, write you a ticket and send you on your way. They raise it from a misdemeanor to a felony, and felonies have different classes based on dollar values. So I think I was the first big bust right after they passed that new law. So they wanted to make it the highest class, so they blamed me for everything in the neighborhood. I was like, I can't carry that many colors. I don't have that many styles and that much time. Well, whatever. So I was up like top of the news for 2 days, front page of the papers. All the press is calling my house. So I had to get out, get a lawyer. And then the thing that bumped me off the news was OJ going down the highway in his white Bronco. That's what got me off the front page. So I guess thanks for that. But because of that exposure, like weird like opportunities came my way. Susan Cervantes from Priscilla Eyes called me and said, hey, come teach. We got this brand new urban youth arts class. Come run the class. Like, all right. Yes. And we'll pay you. I was like, oh, that's way better than the free one I was doing. And then my buddy hooked me up with doing skateboard graphics at Real and Stereo Skateboards, which is still based in San Francisco, I think. So just, you know, mural commissions started pouring in. Even the city of San Francisco gave me commissions, which is hilarious because on one day I'm doing community service for getting busted, and on another day I'm getting paid from the city to paint it. But yeah, it was a crazy time. It was super inspiring, super exciting. And I had to do a lot of community service for that, but I ended up not paying anything. And they were like, oh, you owe so much money, you might as well start paying. And my lawyer said, but you don't buy a car and you don't know how much it costs, so let us know how much it is. Well, they never figured it out, so we never paid anything. And eventually that got expunged, so I guess I'm still a clean person now. But you know, people were mad, so they wanted me to get the stiffest penalties. Those, you know, I met a lot of those conservative anti-graffiti people. I had to work with them as part of my community service for some of it. So you know, it's opening your eyes to things. And then the community service, like you have to show up in the morning, and then different departments in San Francisco assign you. You might go with the fire, you might go with the police, you know, might go in DPW, whatever. And it's usually just cleaning things or rearranging things. And so you start to see all the corruption in the different departments, how workers don't work for 4 hours out of the day. They just turn off their walkie-talkies and go take a nap in the park. Like, wow. So instead of I think that DPW head wanted to discourage me from doing any more art, but it fueled me because I was like, I need to speak about these injustices that are happening, you know, this theft of our public monies. So Priscilla Isles sort of was like, and you know, you look back and you just think, wow, Kupuna my elders must have been like lining me up for these things, because here was this super progressive woman, fearless, you know, big picture, not afraid to tackle heavy politics, believed that all murals should be about political issues, about people's rights, you know. And I think it was the next piece that I needed in my own personal development, where so much of style writing is about me, 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 right? Doing my name like 1,000 times everywhere. And then her perspective of, no, it's for the people, it's by the people, it's in the community. She would give me commissions that were outside of the mission. She wasn't even interested in painting outside the mission. Like, didn't care. So, realizing, like, instead of being pushed away from the community with penalties, it was about bringing me in. And I don't think she realized how much of an impact she was making to kind of politicize me or make me feel more of a connection to the community.
It is really incredible to know that you have had all of these. There were many moments that are very complicated, at the same time that you were able to still do the best out of it. And it put a lot of other people in your way, like Susan Cervantes. And when you think of the mission, or the mission district in San Francisco, what are some of those memories of even projects or murals that you did with Susan, or even this class that you were starting to teach? Because that's an essential thing that continued until this day. That's still something important. What are some of those memories that you have of your life in the mission in those moments when you were actually working with Susan?
You know, to back up a little bit, in the context, I arrived in San Francisco in fall of 86, and style writing was like bumping. It was going crazy.
Golden age of graffiti.
Golden age, yeah. So, but prior to that, you're looking at like the 70s, you have this rich history. I mean, San Francisco at the time was the mural capital of the United States. You had these political murals, a lot of Latino artists, you know, Chicano artists, just holding it down, doing amazing stuff. I mean, you drive around the mission And what are now just memories or postcards or in books was like, that was your living history. These huge, vibrant murals, you know, people dancing salsa and stuff like that. Or, you know, talking like Bami Ali, talking about all the struggles of peoples in third world, you know, how much of that is actually caused by the U.S. Things like that were powerful. So coming in at 86 with style writing was like, what are we doing? Look at what they're doing. You know, it's, you know, I think for a lot of us, we didn't get into it, or we didn't know what it was because we were younger. But for me to see that stuff every day, I mean, Susan's stuff was amazing. She was organizing huge projects at the time. She's such a fearless, you know, like, I'm just going to make the craziest stuff happen kind of person, you know. And then Juana Alicia, her murals, I mean, they're still amazing to me, but the ones at the time, you know, like a kid holding up a flower with guns pointing at the kid, stuff like that, just like in the middle of the road in the mission, just, whoa, such powerful stuff that I hadn't seen in art coming from Hawaii. Hawaii is all about, you know, sunsets and Diamond Head and waves, stuff that tourists will like. But to see those kinds of things, it seeps in, you know. And then getting to work under, I didn't realize that I would be getting a free mentorship from Susan, you know, and all the artists that came through her center and her family. Her family, too, is just amazing, like very loving, you know, they're tight. They have struggled through decades of stuff together to make her career happen. Like, that's phenomenal. But all of that being the melting pot, and then the style writing coming in and changing things, and, you know, seeing, like, people like Regal come in and do these crazy murals that are just like one giant stop sign. Oh, you know, it redefined what mural art was. Not just him, but there was, you know, more people like that. Or then graffiti artists going and doing huge walls with their name, you know, two-story amaze, twist, you know, whatever. People weren't used to that. So everything was changing, not necessarily in a better way that it was about politics or community, but just that so much more stuff was being painted. A lot of styles and different voices were being expressed and experimented on. And then, you know, I'm just jumping into that at an early age and trying to figure out, am I just a writer? Because this stuff is pretty powerful. And then she would have us come paint with them and learn stuff. So, you know, like, she got a commission from a friend who had bought the McDonald's on 24th and Mission. And he said, I don't think the business does as well, so could you paint some murals? And I think that would draw the community in. So she kind of hemmed and hawed because she was so anti-corporations. But she knew this person, and it's in the community. And he said, I have this much money for you, and you can just do whatever you want. So she lined up her team, and she gave us young folks the whole back wall. And all they said was, you know, we're going to talk about the four elements. I don't even know what that is. And I painted some dumb stuff, I think. Some pretty naked burning woman with wings or something like that. And I'm, you know, it's not the kind of stuff I would paint now. But the owner came by one day and he said, thank you, you know, your mural has increased my business 11% overnight. That's huge. So there's that side. And then the more important side was how one day a gangster comes in his big golden red, you know, starter jacket, and he says, yo man, thank you for painting and making our neighborhood look pretty. Like, I lived here my whole life, I've stood on this corner my whole life, and no one ever gave us nothing, and this is the first time somebody came and gave us something, so thank you for that. I was like, wow, that shifted me, what that guy said, you know, like, I want to do that some more. And so with the Urban Youth Arts class, we grew it, you know, we started to get more walls. So the kids would come paint and come sketch in the class like twice a week, and then we would go paint on the weekends, at least one weekend a month, if not the whole month. And Susan would just line up walls for us, and we would just go paint stuff. So it was slowly about, like, coming to know what their identity is. in that community, you know, and then painting about that. I think it started off with just a simple, you know, we're graffiti people, just put our name on it to try to make it more relevant for community. But it was a start. And then she got a big project. I think it was, I think the school is called Cesar Chavez. I don't remember. But there was a mural with Martin Luther King on it. And so she painted this huge Cesar Chavez, I want to say it's like 3 stories tall or something. And she gave us young people, the urban arts class, this sidewall. And it had old graffiti, like, you know, Transformer robots that were fading. But the Malcolm X, I mean, the Martin Luther King kind of survived. So we touched it up, and then we wrote across the top of the wall, above the windows, with love, magic, and art, we shall overcome. And, you know, it's kind of taking a play on one of his, a quote out of one of his speeches, and then adding that beauty. And I didn't realize the power of that until years later, when this person that I admired, he was a union organizer. So his job was to get hired at hotels and then organize the workers to become a union. Like, kind of a bizarre job to have, you know? Because the workers are, I think they're mostly like Chicano or Filipino, and they're afraid of losing their jobs even though they're getting treated badly. So to me, he's like a local hero, you know, doing the work, he's living, he's young, but making this commitment to community. He's studying, this guy was studying like war strategies in order to uplift his community. Like, who does that? So this is a guy I admire, and he comes up to me one day and he goes, "Hey, you remember you painted this school?" "No." "No, you remember it said this?" "Oh, a little bit." Then he finally, like, let me find a picture. And he shows me a picture. I'm like, "Oh, yeah, I remember painting that." He goes, "You don't understand. You want to talk about having a personal relationship with art. I was a young cholo when you guys painted that. And me and my crew would hang out in that schoolyard after hours and drink and sell drugs and fight. And we would jump people in and we would fight other gangs. And we would sit on those jungle gyms at night and wonder, like, why are they painting this mural that says, 'With love, magic, and art, we shall overcome.'" And the mural made us start to realize that what we were doing wasn't appropriate for a schoolyard. So we stopped drinking there, and then we stopped hanging out, we stopped fighting there. And eventually he left the gang and became this union organizer. He's like, "So your art is one of the big things that helped me see what I had to do in life and got me out of the gangs." And I was like, wow. No one ever told me anything like that. You know, like, if my art can do that for one more person in my life, it's a win. So those little moments, they change you, you know.
Those are all beautiful moments, and I think that when I think of the street art that I've been able to observe in the mission, it's really nice to see that there's also that influence that you had, not only with the actual art, but also educating others, children, youth, to also be able to know how to do that and what to depict too. And even your choice of images, how it continued changing. Do you remember there was I think it was in Hyde Street in San Francisco, I think there was like a mural that you got, I think, commissioned. It was it was on Hyde Street. You have too many. I think it's just like the same thing that you're saying. Just like, depending on the mural, depending on the art, you still were having some feedback from the community, right? Like, and people were still reaching out to you, like, "This is not only art, this is, you're giving this as a gift to us. Like, thank you for giving us something," when there was so much that was taken from these communities and has been continued to be taken. When you think of your time in, you know, not only doing these kinds of murals and also with Susan, that you just explained such a beautiful mentorship and relationship, You think also of, for example, Nancy Pili Hernandez, which I mentioned earlier. And there's this beautiful project that you created several murals in different parts of the world, that is the water rights murals. What was the drive or the idea? Where did it come from, and why did you decide to collaborate with other artists doing this, including Nancy?
I had one of my best friends in Hawaii. His name was Corey. He wanted to do projects together. We were good friends in high school, you know. He was this Hawaiian guy. We would lay on this basketball court at night and dream of, like, what could we do to make our world better? And it would just be he and I, and we would see this one lone white pu'eo, this Hawaiian owl, in our valley. It was probably the last Hawaiian pu'eo in our valley. And it would just come to us at night. And I didn't know back then how significant that was or what it meant for us. But this guy, Corey, reaches out to me, and then he wants to do some projects. So he goes, you got to see this series. The internet was still just kind of getting going to the point of, like, past news groups to actually having sites and video and stuff. So there was this series. It was called something like Toxic Monster Island or something like that. It was about the big trash in the Pacific. And he showed me that, and I was just so shocked at how much trash was out there. You know, when we were young, the beaches were pristine. You would go out in the morning and there'd be shells or glass balls from the fishermen's nets. But you could get these things. You could get shells and make puka shell necklaces. And now you can't go to the beach and get enough to even make a bracelet. And there's so much microplastics in our beaches that we can't even filter it out. It's so small, you just see billions of little colors. But it wasn't like that when we were young. And to see that video where they're fishing up, you know, pieces of houses and whole refrigerators and just all whatever floats there and everything growing on it, I thought, oh, we need to do more about this. We got to stop this trash in the ocean. So one mural is not going to be enough, so we're going to have to do a series of murals. And then, you know, as an artist, I was applying for grants. Artist grants are usually like, oh, we have 1% of the budget. We're building this new building. We got to put it towards some art. So I don't know, let's make a mural about this lawyer. Like, lawyer? Like, who's this lawyer? You know what I mean? Like, who even knows this person? So a lot of those commission opportunities were just not something I could resonate with. And I had all these ideas of what I'd like to do with projects. So then one day, one of my good friends, he ended up becoming a founder of Twitter. And he goes, dude, you're not going to believe this. This project I'm working on, it's like gangbusters. So I got to pay this money. Either it's going to go to the U.S. for taxes, and fuck that, because they're going to make bombs. So let's do these projects we've always been talking about. All right, so we started this nonprofit. And we probably should have did some research before we did it, because maybe a nonprofit wasn't the smartest way to go, but we didn't know better. But so we did it, and we started that water rights. And I thought, if we can do like 10 murals in 10 cities at the same time, and all of this is streaming live on the internet, that every, you know, it'd be a big hoopla around it. Didn't dawn on me how much work it takes to plan each mural when you're trying to deal with other countries and other artists and other environmental groups. So I think in a year we did like 8 or 9, and it took another 6 months or so to do several more. But everywhere we went, people didn't want to talk about trash in the ocean. They wanted to talk about access to clean drinking water and who controlled the water. And it was the same story everywhere. Privatization, you know, rampant pollution, destroying our most valuable resource on the planet. It makes no sense. So that's how water rights forms, sort of organically. I had hired my friend Nancy Pili to coordinate it because she was good at stuff. We had that trust already. We already saw each other as comrades in, you know, people's movement, and we're getting more into environmental stuff. So she made it happen with that money. Yeah, we did some significant things that happened in that series of murals was like Palestine, sending a team out, you know, one guy from LA, one guy from San Francisco, from the mission, Josue Rojas, and them having, you gotta like fly into Israel and then you gotta kind of sneak your way into Palestine and say that, oh, I'm here for a conference or whatever the heck you're gonna say, right? And then they would, we did it in partnership with this group that always goes there, and they set up desalinization units so the kids can have water. And they're building these things in schools because Israel's bombed all the wells, all the drinking sites, all the sewage treatment plants. So they're slowly just trying to kill them off by just removing any resources and making it as toxic for them as possible. So they build these desalinization units in the schools so their kids can drink the water. So we go with them. People are building those units, installing those units. We're painting murals. I think they did like 9 or 10 schools in 9 days or something like that. And all of them are gone now because in the last couple raids, Israel blew up all of those schools. So that was, you know, powerful thing. South Africa, we went out there and partnered with people there. And, you know, let's say we spend $25,000, $35,000 to make a mural happen. And you realize, like, wait, how much does it cost if we just dug a well for them and taught them how to maintain the well? You know, like, we were creating a mural and marketing towards English-speaking people, primarily in the U.S., when we could have really been about the people there and dug the wells and set up education systems and, you know, ways that they could, like, monetize so that they could maintain those systems. So just a wake-up call for us on what are we really doing to help people? Are we pandering to our own ego? Are we actually trying to, you know, make it better for them? So water rights was like this learning ground for us to figure things like that out. Nancy Peely organized one in Richmond, California, where there's, I think Shell or Chevron have their oil refineries. And, you know, every few years, one of those parts of that facility catches on fire and is this huge thing burning oil for days on end. And everybody gets sick. And those companies cover it up, you know. So she really wanted to put it on blast, like, this is not acceptable. You know, all the poor people have the land where all those chemicals go, and all the wealthy people have the spot out of the wind where they don't get those chemicals. I think that was maybe the last mural in that series we did, but it really made us realize how much we could do to connect the art to the stories of the place. So it was hard to get that funded, because funders couldn't see the impact of you going into a place for a couple weeks and creating a piece of art and then leaving. They want to see, like, a year after year program in one community serving the same kids, you know, same demographic. So that was kind of hard to get funded. But then it led to us developing a series of murals in Hawaii called Mele Murals. And learning from water rights, I spent an entire year just taking 3 to 5 meetings a week with different community members. Everybody from politicians to nonprofits to artists to youth groups, and telling them, like, here's what we think we're going to do. Here's this project. What do you think? And they would give us feedback. So taking that feedback and adding everything, it made it so much more than what we were going to ever build. I think I was still pandering to my own ego, like, I'm going to do this swan song of 20 murals about Hawaiian songs and then peace, I'm out. Instead, we're like 65 murals in and still about teaching young people how to be those visual storytellers, grounded in place, connected to their land, connected to their ancestors, to their stories, you know, to their culture. So much more than anything I could have built myself. So going back to what you said, yeah, the kupuna watching over you. I think when you set yourself on a righteous path, a pono path, that people and resources will come into your path to empower you. And when you're trying to go down the wrong path, it's just obstacle after obstacle, because they're trying to tell you, look, what, open your eyes. This is not the direction for you. And Melon Murals was that. Like, everything came. Money came. Partnerships came. Walls came. I'm at the point now where I realize the site calls us. The space, the land calls us. So people go, how do you choose the walls? We don't, you know. People find us. And it's always like, okay, what is up with this place? Why is this place calling us? What kind of healing does this place need, you know? And we've since learned things like land holds the memory of things that happened there, whether they're traumatic or they're positive. So if it's traumatic, then, you know, a lot of bad things will continue happening there. It's just a low vibration place, right? But you can help cleanse it. You can bring people in to lift out that negative energy, to clear out spirits that are stuck there, to clear out dark energy, and then make it this portal, or make it this this kipuka, this spouting place of like new life or new beginnings or creativity. And when you do that at a school, it's hugely transformative. So taking, you know, what I learned back in style writing, boom, bright colors really catches you. Dynamic things really captures people. It might not be what people want to hang in their living room, or I should say what wealthy people want to hang in their living room, but it's definitely what is going to capture people's eyes and captivates kids. And then, you know, looking at color theory, how colors resonate and stuff like that, you know, more of a normal kind of art things. How do you incorporate those things to make that energy of that place feel different, to raise the vibration for those kids and that community? I don't know. I went on a lot of tangents, so I don't know where we are now.
No, like what I was telling you, when you think of normal interviews, which this is not that, right? This is not even an interview. It's an oral history. You're really connecting a lot of dots that are just very important. And even one thing that I just noticed is how much of an influence did San Francisco have on you and on you creating these Mele murals, but also in you creating these opportunities for youth and for telling your own stories, actually reflecting of the place, which you were also doing that kind of a public engagement with art before, but that kind of site specific and with the stories of the people and reflecting the community back. It's very nice that you were able to combine all of the things you learned as a kid and as a teenager in Hawaii with the things that then you learned in the 80s in San Francisco and beyond. And it all seems to be very well connected and very well grounded. You are telling the stories and letting people, kids, tell the stories with these murals and with this work. And I think that one of the nice things about the murals that you've been describing, that you were trying to do a swan song, is that it became bigger than even what you thought. And it might have been, like, as you were saying, there's like some part of you that you were like, I'm doing this for myself a little bit. It became way larger than that. And it's so important that it always ends up like that with most murals. It is very much collaboration. It is very much about the place. And one of the nice things is you've been able to do this thanks also to your nonprofit, which is the Estria Foundation. And Mele Murals also became a documentary, which I was very happy to be able to watch, to know exactly the impact you've been having on over there in Honolulu, but also just beyond. And when you think of your current work, right, your, I would say, the legacy that you're leaving behind in Honolulu, I think that is very important. I would like to ask you, what do you think that legacy is in your own words? Because I know what I'm seeing. I know what others see in you. But what do you see in you when you think of your own legacy?
I wasn't sure I had a legacy yet. I mean, I hope that I'm creating opportunities. You know, I credit Susan Cervantes with letting me lead that class at her center. And then from there was East Bay Asian Youth Center and Urban Arts Academy in Oakland. And then finally going to Eastside Arts Alliance and launching an urban arts class there. But where Susan's class, it was just, you know, maybe because of me at the time, it was more graffiti-centric. And then going to Eastside Arts Alliance, it started to become, it's a graffiti-ish class, but it's definitely about politicizing young people so they understand why they're oppressed, why their community is the way they are, and then how to be a voice for the people and communicate these things on the walls. And so all of that led to the Mele Murals, where we teach the young people to be this voice for the community. So I keep hoping that the Mele Murals and all the programs that have been built off of it since then would develop the young people to be these visual storytellers. And I don't know, you know, how many of them are going to take that route. But I do know that the meditation piece is probably even bigger than the mural piece. The mural is this landmark that lasts for how many years, right? And people see it. Millions of people will see the walls. But the meditation is the thing that you can use to work on yourself. And that's real change. When you change yourself, you know, you change the head of the dragon and the whole body of the dragon changes. And so it's a ripple effect, right, into your family, into your household, your community, and farther out. And the meditation and also helps them ground and connect to the land and try to feel what the land feels and know that it's a living thing that we have to take care of. And connect to your ancestors for inspiration and guidance. Like, you can ask them any question, like, should I go to this event? You know, should I hire this person? Should I do this project? They're always there for you. And I think for a lot of people in the United States feel a disconnect. They don't know who they are, where they come from. And indigenous people are all about, like, you gotta know where you came from to know where you gotta go. So I hope that our projects help to connect the kids to their, and not just the kids, because we work with teachers and, you know, adults too, but connect the participants to their genealogy, to their place, and then connect them to their future. So I don't know if I'll be famous in the end. I don't really think that matters. But if the work has an impact, that's what it's all about.
I think that when you think of that impact you have, that is that legacy, because it is not about necessarily creating the next generation of, you know, street artists or muralists, or it's about by them learning these kinds of skills, but also these kinds of thinking, or as you're saying, meditation, they change themselves. And if they change themselves or the ways of thinking about the world and themselves, then they can also affect more sustaining change and accept what, as you were saying, the land, the water, what surrounds them is as important as it is. And you've also taught them another thing, I think, which is the value of community and the value of conversation, constant conversation. It's also that kind of very incredible thing you've been doing with Nancy Pili Hernandez, Josue Rojas, which you just mentioned, with Susan Cervantes, and even since your early days in San Francisco in the 80s, just understanding your place in a place and occupying that in a way that also gives back to the community, Estria. And I think that anyone that cares to hear your words today will be able to witness that you are a person that has understood that kind of space and has led other people to do that, especially younger people. And I think that that's just such an essential thing. I think I have only a couple of more questions. One of them is just one thing that I think I ask often in these kinds of oral histories, which is, what is something that you need to tell me or for someone that listens to this so that they can better understand you as a person?
What can I tell you so they better understand me? I hope that they get that I have tried to grow and improve myself and be closer to my truer self, you know? Yeah, I guess that's it.
The other one that I wanted to ask you is just, when you think of like all of these interviews you've had during the years, all these media attention tour, even opportunities of documenting your work, this is a different kind of conversation in which you're able to say and express yourself in whichever way you want and tell your story. One thing that I think we don't get asked enough is this kind of, what is it that you haven't been able to say before, or that you would like to expand that you have not been able to say? So when you think of that, like, is there anything that comes to mind of something you would like to say that you haven't been able to before, or you didn't want to?
I probably want to say sorry to all the people I've hurt along the way that, you know, stupid or whatever. And thank you to so many people that helped me become what I am, to empower me to do the work that I do. Actually, this interview, this talk story session has helped me kind of reflect on how each of those things had a key pivotal moments in my life. So thank you for that.
I would say just thank you. It's been a true honor to be able to know that in this very weird year that we have had, that I'm able to talk to you. You're in Honolulu, I'm here in Oakland, and that we're able to just reminisce on the person you are, and all the steps and all these things that happen along the way. And I'm glad that you were able to just tell us some of these stories. And thank you so much for not only your time, but also all of these beautiful things that you are still doing and that you have done so far. And all of those other things that you were saying also, like, you know, like, even I would like to say sorry. They did take you places, and you still did. You have a lot of impact. So thank you so much for everything you're still doing.
Thank you. I appreciate this opportunity.
I hope that after listening to this oral history, you also understand what Estria realized during our recording of it. It is his belief that Kapuna, his elders and ancestors, paved the road for his life and growth. Working on his art and practicing and creating in great volumes were necessary ingredients for Estria to develop his own style and work. The tags and writings of his name in street art were some of the first and significant steps in that direction. After time spent working on public art in partnership with muralists, he realized the collective and collaborative worth found in working on murals and grew to become more aware of the power of his art and work. Pulling from his time spent learning and creating with Bay Area muralists, Estria continues to honor his heritage and traditions while living in Hawaii through the Estria Foundation and the Mele Murals Project, which is described on its website as a foundation which promotes youth development, arts education, cultural preservation, and community building through the creation of large-scale outdoor murals. This oral history of Estria Miyashiro was a collaborative effort, like murals also are. The team behind it was
Erica Gengzi,
Maisa Plunk Graham,
who served as executive producers,
Natalia De La Rosa,
who served as a production assistant,
Justin Ochong,
who provided us with recording assistance in Honolulu, Hawaii. The rest of the team included
Javier Briones,
Kevin Carr,
Chad Curver,
Carrie Cordova,
Stephanie Garces,
Melissa San Miguel.
And it was produced and mixed by me, Camilo Garzon. The Mission Murals Project was organized by the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art and funded by the Institute for Museum and Library Services. Thanks for listening.